I was having my doubts as to the effectiveness of some social justice strategies. One that, unfortunately, feel the need to kick off the cart is speaking truth to power. You ever heard, probably heard that saying before. We need to go speak truth to power. Yet in today's world, narratives are created by spin doctors, pundits, TV and radio personalities, and ideologues. They create their own version of truth and facts. Truth to them is nothing more than an irritating obstacle in their way. Something that's in their way of their own little personal agenda. Something like an insect to be swatted away. For the most part, speaking truth to power is of no concern to those in power. So what do you do? Well, recently a strategy that's kind of gaining some traction is the idea of public shaming. Actually, there's precedent for that in our culture, who we are as people, and in social justice movements. No one wants to bring shame upon their tribe or their people. Actually, author Steven Pinker, in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, says, despite what you might believe, contrary to what you might believe, the world has actually never been safer. This is the safest the world has ever been, at least for us as humans. That's for us as humans. Why? Because people, countries, dictators don't want to look bad on the world stage. In the age of mass media and instant data communications around the world, blatant atrocities would be in every living room the next day. People don't want to be shamed in that way, even dictators. Many of Gandhi's and Martin Luther King Jr.'s nonviolent actions were staged and carried out for maximum publicity and effect. Not that that was the primary thrust, but it was done. Scenes of Bull Connor's reaction to peaceful civil rights protesters in Birmingham were transmitted to every TV screen in America on that same day. And Americans didn't want to be associated with the turning of attack dogs and fire hoses on peaceful citizens. It was shameful to our vision of America. And it was a turning point in the civil rights movement. But I began to think that since people don't care much about truth and facts, maybe this shaming thing could be adapted and used to create social justice in our communities, in the nation, and in the world. But I began to think about it a little bit more. And I'm wondering if in all cases this shaming has actually made things better. Has it made things better, or might it merely just shape-shift the injustice into some other form and not truly confront it? In the state of Alabama, on the third Monday of January, is the Martin Luther King holiday. Imagine that. The state of Selma, Birmingham, Montgomery. The third Monday of January, Martin Luther King's Sunday, a holiday in Alabama. It also happens to be, in Alabama, a state holiday celebrating Robert E. Lee's birthday. Ouch. Ouch. In Alabama, they still celebrate Confederate Memorial Day. They still celebrate as a state holiday Jefferson Davis's birthday. In Georgia, we used to celebrate Robert E. Lee's birthday in January, but it was shape-shifted to be Robert E. Lee's birthday celebrated in November then. And now that day is merely an unnamed state holiday in Georgia. The fourth Monday in April in Georgia used to be Confederate Memorial Day. Now it's shape-shifted into this unnamed state holiday. Maybe shaming, and yes, maybe even some of the nonviolent strategies of Martin Luther King and Gandhi haven't and didn't really change things for the better in all cases. Maybe these strategies merely shape-shifted the injustice, the narrative, and drove it underground. We're still dealing with these issues all the time. Actually, there's more evidence for that than that they've done good. Social researcher Brené Brown writes, "Shame never drives positive behavior. What shame drives is rage, anger, rationalization, and blame. Let's say white supremacists or the KKK or Nazis are marching through town and you say, let's shame them. Well, let me tell you, if they weren't ass high in shame already, they wouldn't be marching through town. Dehumanization is not a social justice tool. It's emotional offloading, gratuitous, self-indulgent. It's a way to offload our anger, our fear, and our rage, but it is not a social justice tool. Brené Brown. Shaming and its online and Twitter counterparts, cancel culture and call-out culture, it's mean-spirited, self-serving, and really lazy. And let's not confuse it as a social justice tool. Proponents of those methods think they're tearing down the walls of injustice, but really they're just building up new ones. And they're burning their bridges behind them as well. Wow, their opponents are merely digging trenches and tunnels, shape-shifting the injustice into some other form. And what bothers me about this kind of behavior, you see it online a lot, it has nothing to do with, it seeks no relationship to the other. It doesn't even see the other's humanity. So, how can we bridge this gap with others? Well, thinking about it superficially, let's look at three options. One, the third path, which I'll call the third rail. If you know about like how a train, like a subway train works, there's a rail where one's touching leads to one's dying, okay? You touch the rail, you die. The third rail is to do nothing. It's apathy. It just lets things spin out of control until they go beyond the point of no return. That's not an option that I will be advocating here today, okay? I'm not going to do that. The second option I call the our backs are against the wall option or path. It's the path of last resort. It's also a path of moral weakness. Circumstances are such that you're at an impasse, so you have to unite and work together to survive. Such circumstances might include economic threats. Republicans and Democrats agree that China is an economic threat to our way of life. They steal our intellectual property. They're developing 5G technology that they've stolen much from us. Republicans and Democrats agree on China as being an economic threat. Other threats could be threats to our democracy, how we do democracy. They've come under threat in the last few elections. It has the potential to unite us against a common foe. And this is not to mention war. Conventional war, nuclear war, cyber war, it could unite us. environmental threats. Believe me, if Wall Street goes under, and I'm talking about going underwater, if Wall Street goes underwater, the powers that be will come together. There's money to be had. But the first path, the first road, is unfortunately the road less traveled. And one might call it the path comprised of relational first principles. First principles, fundamental concepts, fundamental ideas on how to relate with one another, especially when we're talking about others with whom we disagree, others with whom we are not in covenant like we are in this space. Talking about others outside with whom we disagree. People we might not even really like that much, right? Or at least we don't think so. But we are Unitarian Universalists who believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And it includes those with whom we disagree. It includes those with whom we are not in covenant outside our walls. And we have to accept that. One's inherent worth and dignity may be hidden and buried and so encased in false narratives and anger that we can't see it. It's certainly not apparent in the white supremacist neo-Nazi marching through town. But speaking for me, I believe that inherent worth and dignity is in there. I know you don't have to believe that if you don't want to, but I do. And they don't even know it themselves. It's been so, because their lives have been so wrapped up and encased in anger and other things. But I believe it's fundamental. So what might these stepping stones or first principles be on this road less traveled, so that we can relate to others unlike ourselves? This was essentially the question that Jennifer Philippi gave to me over lunch one day. She purchased this sermon as part of our service auction, and she dropped this kind of bomb on me, and it turned kind of into a monster. I wrote about 10,000 words in this sermon. Most of them are about 2,000, so I had to do some editing. But I've been thinking about it for about 3 or 4 months now. But last month, I was riding on MARTA on my way from the state capitol. I was down there for the day. I was riding home, reading the New York Times on my phone, and I came across a story that clicked, and it turned a small light on for me. I only have small lights. A small light on for me. The article was titled, A Disgusting Yale Professor Moves On. And it was about sociology professor Nicholas Christakis and his reaction to a student-led revolt on campus. See, earlier in the week, his wife, also a professor at Yale, sent a memo supporting freedom of speech, that the students on campus should be allowed to wear any Halloween costume they like, even if it's culturally offensive. Because she trusted that the students could hold one another accountable and be responsible in doing that, should someone wear something that is culturally offensive. And she also mentioned in the note that her husband also supported this position. Well, a predictable firestorm erupted on campus. And an encounter between Mr. Christakis and about 100 students is on YouTube. You can go watch it, at least part of it. It's only part of it. Some, but not all by any means, but some of the student behavior exhibited in this encounter, no doubt fueled by real rage, real fear, and perhaps real trauma, represented this shaming, cancel culture, call-out culture behavior. "Be quiet," a woman yells at him in his face. "Be quiet. Who the F hired you? You shouldn't sleep at night. You're disgusting." Right in his face. I don't know what happens next. I don't know what happened the next day or after that. I don't have that context. All I can see what was in that video, when she gets done, she picks up her bag, turns around, and leaves. She didn't have any interest in talking to him, hearing what he had to say. She unloaded on him and left. And maybe she had to do that, but I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's a healthy narrative, healthy way to converse or change anything. Interestingly, how she did that is how things happen on Facebook. People say their stuff, hit enter, right? And then either shut the computer or block the person because they don't want to hear. They don't want to be responsible for actually hearing what the other person had to say. I could have told Mr. Christakis, if you sent a memo like that, you're going to get some blowback. Yeah. They're going to come looking for you, and you can run, but you can't hide. But the thing is, he wasn't running. A couple hundred students gather on campus and to protest this. And what does he do? He walks out right into the middle of them, into the belly of the beast, to listen to what they had to say. He talked some as well, but mostly he listened. Mostly he listened for 2 hours. 2 hours while they insulted him, unloaded on him with tirades and hateful speech for 2 hours. Why would he do this? Why would he subject himself to that? Well, I believe he did it for two reasons. The second and less important, and he says this in the article, is that he believed that he needed to model the principles that he believed in. But the most important reason, I believe, is that him, despite, here's a quote, "seeing firsthand the effects of over-identifying with one's group and witnessing mass delusions up close, despite that, he believes that our species, we are wired, we are predisposed to the good. We've evolved to both give and receive love and to want to do that. We've evolved and been wired to cooperate and to create healthy communities. He says this in a book called Blueprint that he wrote after this incident, mind you. After the incident, he published this book, Blueprint, that has all the data. After reading the article and seeing these YouTube videos of this encounter, the light that went on me was this. I could give you a laundry list of principles that are good, that are worthy and valuable, but maybe they're not really the first principles at all. Maybe they're just merely tools, strategies, and that these tools are ineffective unless you have an underlying orientation, an underlying way of being that enables those tools to come to fruition in a positive way. And without that orientation, without that way of being, the tools can merely become even Machiavellian-like machinations that can be used to shape-shift the narrative, cause it to go underground into some new form. In the video, you can see Mr. Christakis doing all the tools, using all the tools that I could mention. But it's really his underlying way of being, his orientation, that makes that possible and genuine and authentic. Very few people, I believe, embody that kind of being. I don't claim to either. It's something I aspire to. What discourages me is that most people don't even care to embody it. The cancel culture, the call-out people, the people who shame on Facebook and whatever, they don't care about having a relationship or embody that kind of orientation. How do you feel about the people in the vehicles that are sporting an NRA sticker? How do you feel about the people in the vehicle of vehicle that sports a Blue Lives Matter sticker or a Black Lives Matter sticker? How do you feel about the person wearing the Make America Great Again hat? How do you feel about Mitch McConnell or even Hillary Clinton? Is the whole sole reason for your political advocacy merely to just trounce the Republicans or the Democrats? Might you be one of the 42% of the people who think that Republicans are downright evil and lack the traits to be fully human? If you are, well, congratulations, because there's a group of Republicans who feel the same way about you. We reap what we sow, a plague on both your houses. Things will not change unless we are reoriented as Mr. Christakis is. It won't change. Unless we remove our knee-jerk responses to Make America Great Again or NRA or whatever, we'll never be oriented to even be able to implement any first principles. I heard a little bit of it today in what Dwana shares with her son-in-law, who has some issues. But she realizes she has to stay in the game and be oriented to see his humanity in order to possibly raise her grandchild together. That's what I'm talking about here. Thank you for sharing that. We need to be reoriented in a new way to even have a prayer. To have a prayer. To not only see the humanity of others, but also, despite not necessarily liking them all the time, but loving them for who they are. To have faith and hope, not only in the inherent worth and dignity of the other, but the inherent goodness of them as well. It's in there somewhere. Mr. Christakis writes, "Beneath all our inventions, our tools, our farms, our machines, our cities and nations, we carry within us innate proclivities to build a good society. Why can't we be the ones oriented towards bringing out these innate proclivities? Why can't we be the ones oriented toward bringing out the best in everyone? In the other, those with whom we disagree. Why can't we be the ones? Why not us? Let us be the ones to take the first step. Let us be the ones, the first ones, to offer an olive branch. Let us be the ones to lean in and to begin building this house of peace for us all."